How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio, here with a brand new show this week, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Awesome show scheduled for today. A show that is close to my heart. Literally! Weird Washington, your travel guide to Washington's local legends and best-kept secrets. Jefferson Davis, the author of this book, is going to be on the program today talking about all of the strangest things from my neck of the woods. Very excited about this one. Of course, we're going to open, as we do every week, with Carl Stern of CarlStern.com, talking all of the news, which, of course, you can find at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. And, Carl, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Brian. It's been a very long week at work for me, experiencing real-life true crime and just trying to get awake right now. It's been a long week, and but I'm up, I'm awake, I'm happy, I'm ready to go, ready to learn about Weird Washington, one of the few states in the continental United States I've never made it to yet. The Pacific Northwest is still on my travel to-do list, so I'm about to start making me a list when I listen to today's show.
Now, last time we were on the show, we were talking about the satellite that was scheduled to crash to Earth. And I, of course, was gravely concerned that it might crash into my house. That did not happen. Ended up falling into the Pacific. And turns out we've now got another satellite that's scheduled to crash land in November. And as we talked about last week, it's not unusual for satellites to fall out of the sky. What is different this time is that the media has picked up on it and, I guess, scared people into thinking that perhaps a satellite could crash into their house. It is very unlikely, but as we mentioned last week, anything can happen.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, what was, I thought, pretty funny about this particular satellite that everybody was watching and wondering what was going to happen to it. They lost it. It took them quite a while to figure out where exactly it crashed. And the original school of thought was, of course, that it did crash into the Pacific, but they thought it crashed near Seattle, Washington. But as it turns out, I believe they finally have determined, although I don't believe they've recovered anything from it or have any actual video of it crashing, somewhere perhaps in the South Pacific, around the South Pacific Islands down there. So, and I'm not even sure they're 100% certain of that yet, but it seems like all the evidence seems to indicate. So I was kind of worried that perhaps you might have a chunk laying in your yard you just didn't know about, but I guess they've backed off that story now.
No satellite pieces here in the yard, but I do have moles, which, doesn't have anything to do with anything, but I was thinking of when I looked into my backyard to see if there was a satellite down there, and instead I saw a hole that was caused by a mole. Unacceptable. Oh. But, another story we were talking about last week that we should do a quick follow-up on is the story of perhaps the speed of light being breached. And you talked about this quite a bit last week, and tests still taking place, people attempting to recreate these experiments. And as of the time I'm recording this update, it is still a wait-and-see story.
Again, until this thing's peer-reviewed by some scientific journal, and I'm not even sure what scientific journal would cover such things, I'm sure there's a quantum physics journal out there, but until the peer review process takes place, I mean, it's all speculation. You're just going simply about what their preliminary results of the testing is. But I mean, it's all over the news. It's certainly something everyone's talking about, and so I think the peer review process for this is going to be particularly intensive, just because it's so game changing. And so anytime, I mean, you think about it as it would be analogous to something in the health industry. If someone came out and today and said, "Hey, we've conclusively proven we can cure cancer," and it's undergoing the peer review process now for publication in, you know, the American Journal of Medicine or something like that. Well, obviously, that would be extraordinarily scrutinized and to see if the science holds up. And this is kind of the equivalent to that. I mean, breaking the speed of light is one of the fundamental laws of physics, as we believe it. But when you get on the quantum level, there are so many things that don't make sense with the law of physics, and not only just on the quantum level, but on the larger level, when you're dealing with things like black holes and intense gravity and things like that, where the laws of physics do seem to be bent, and you have these particles on the quantum level that seem to flash in and out of existence. They seem to not follow the laws of energy conservation, where they seem to not change to another state. They just seem to fade in and out of existence, and those things too seem opposed to the laws of physics. So to think that something on the quantum level could in fact break the speed of light, I again don't find it as unbelievable as it might seem on the surface, because there are a lot of things we just don't understand how it works there yet. So this is going to be a major thing if it turns out to be true, and especially if it stands up to peer review. It's going to be a game changer. And you know, with the Hadron Collider now, we're going to start running into a lot more of this stuff that doesn't seem to add up. I think we're going to start learning a lot more. I'm not sure what the latest is on the so-called God particle that they've been trying to discover with the Hadron Collider, but there was the great fear that thing was going to cause miniature black holes to form and suck the Earth into them. And anytime you're dealing with mad science, as I like to call it, you know, back 7,500 years ago, there seemed to be the term was mad scientist, and it's something we don't use anymore today. But you know, you think about these people with these giant colliders creating the potential for miniature black holes, and you think about passing the speed of light and things like that. And you know, you think back even with Oppenheimer when they were doing the Manhattan Project and working on the atomic bomb and later the hydrogen bomb. You know, Oppenheimer was famously quoted as saying he wasn't sure when they ignited the hydrogen bomb that it wasn't going to ignite the atmosphere and destroy the Earth. He didn't believe that would happen, but he could not rule it out as 100% as a possibility. So, you know, we still have mad scientists running around today, and I think it's fantastic. Just, hey, I'm all for cloning everything and just ramming particles together and seeing what happens, and it's just great. It's a new age of science, and it's about time we started breaking some new. So, I mean, science had kind of slowed since the space race age. I mean, we've turned to more, I guess, a lot of biological type stuff. We've got into cloning. We've got into a lot of, you know, breaking the code of DNA and things of that nature. And all that's wonderful. But I really love the stuff where we get into this weird science and stuff like quantum physics and really going out into space and seeing what's happening. And that's the stuff I love to hear about.
I'm still skeptical about this speed of light deal. I'm not a scientist, but I mean, when I hear that the speed of light is broken, and I hear that, or they believe that they may have found something that traveled faster than light, and you look at it, and you know, it's not like it was, you know, 1 meter per second faster. You know, I don't want to say a substantial amount faster, but it was faster. But it also wasn't like twice as fast. So to me, if it's just a little bit faster, I think, okay, well, you know, maybe human error, device error. I mean, these are the first things that come into my mind. You know, if it were double, I mean, same thing would probably come to my mind as well. Like, really? Double the speed of light? But that would at least be something that it is a dramatic difference. Something that you could go, okay, if several people are noticing twice the speed of light, then maybe we've got something here. But just like a little bit faster with certain instruments, it's kind of like, maybe there's some human error or some instrument error here or something of that nature.
Oh, yeah. How do you measure this stuff? I mean, it's, to me, that's another thing that's fascinating. It's like you said, who knows what the margin of error is on it? And when you're dealing with something like that, there's no margin of error, room for any margin of error. And so, that's why it's got to undergo the peer review process and get checked out. And you know, these are preliminary results. And again, you know, the implications are fascinating if it holds up, but we should know. And usually it takes a year or so for all that to be ultimately hashed out and published, and there's going to be a lot of skepticism. So I have a feeling if this stands up to peer review, then you've got good results. I mean, there's going to be, I'm sure there's more scientists than not involved in the process that think this is complete hogwash. So if the evidence stands up, it stands. If not, well, then back to the drawing board.
Yes, the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, which comes out to 671 million miles per hour. So we're talking about in terms of margin of error in determining the exact speed of light. I mean, you know, instruments are getting more precise, certainly more precise every day. And I don't know. Again, I'm not a scientist. We should bring a scientist onto the show to talk about this. But, you know, as far as like how precise are instruments getting, I mean, could it not conceivably be a situation where machines are now more precise and we just have a better determination of what the actual speed of light is? Perhaps the speed of light is slightly faster than we thought.
Oh, yeah. Well, exactly. I think the speed of light itself is probably accurately measured, because it's one of those things that you don't have to actually measure an object going the speed of light. I mean, I think you can determine that with just the physics of energy itself and its terminal velocity. So I think that could be, you know, figured out by mathematical formula pretty consistently. So, you know, it's just one of those known things, kind of like, you know, pi. You know, it is a fact. And so, but again, how do you measure it? And one of the things that, and this is a guy I should actually hook the show up with, because I've talked to him a few times. He's not actually a friend of mine, but he is an acquaintance of mine, and his name is Dr. Jim Tour, and he's a professor of nanotechnology at Rice University, and he and his team actually have built a car, a working, functioning car out of chemicals that's the smallest car ever made. It's made out of just a few molecules, and it has actually a working engine. It has a working independent suspension, tires, axles, the whole thing that they have created chemically. Just a few molecules wide, and so when you get to dealing with things of that size, you know, how do you measure these things? Well, he would be the guy to ask, and I could easily get him up on this show. But you know, it's just fascinating how things like that are now created, and you know, we can't even see these. So you couldn't even see that without an electron microscope or something. So how do you measure that? How do you it's just mind blowing some of the things we're doing now with science. And when you get into quantum physics, you're talking about parts of the pieces of that thing. If you've got a car that's been built and has been built of just a few molecules wide, when you're talking about quantum physics, you're talking about a molecule of several atoms, and you're talking about getting the smallest parts of those atoms. And breaking those down even to the smallest things that exist, and that's just incredible, some of the advancements we've made, not only, you know, going out into the universe, but also down into the microverse and the discoveries we've made. It's really those are the scientists that really don't get the credit they deserve for some of the work they're doing.
Yeah, we need to get this fellow on the show.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
That's my conclusion.
It's easily done. I could take care of that.
The neutrinos, by the way, that supposedly traveled faster than the speed of light, they arrived early, it says, nanoseconds early, corresponding to 18 meters in a total distance of 730 kilometers. So it's very, very, very slightly, presumably faster than, or allegedly faster than the speed of light. So we shall see. We'll talk more about this next week, but very interesting story. In fact, there's a story up on AfterDarkRadioShow.com right now, somewhat related to this. Einstein was wrong. Perhaps he was not. The headline here, General Theory of Relativity Proved by Cosmic Experiment. So while it could turn out, conceivably, that he was wrong about the speed of light, he was correct about general relativity, a new experiment this week. Scientists believe has proved that, and the story is up on AfterDarkRadioShow.com right now.
Yeah. I was clearly. I mean, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity has stood up to scrutiny for what 56, I guess 75 years now or so. And so, yeah, I mean, this again, if it turns out you can break the speed of light, again, I don't think Einstein's theory of relativity collapse on that. I think it's just something that is now, actually, if anything, it opens it up and removes some boundaries it had previously. So again, we'll see where it ends up. A year from now, this may be a absolute non-story, and a year from now, it may be one of the greatest scientific breakthroughs of quantum physics that may have ever took place.
All right, before we head out to talk Weird Washington, for new listeners here, Carl, everyone tell them very quickly about the weirdest place in Alabama.
The weirdest place in Alabama. There are a lot of weird places in Alabama. To me, one of my favorites is the face on the courthouse window in Pickens County, Alabama, which, again, is about, I don't know, about 50 miles from here. I've seen it many times, and it's one of those things that you actually can see. It's not just something that you have to sit there and go, well, I guess if you hold your head right, you can see it, or it's one of those things that everybody says happens, like a ghost walking down the road, or any of the crybaby hollows and things like that. No, there is a face, in fact, that you can see, no question about it. They even have a sign pointing to it in the courthouse window in Pickens County, supposedly of a condemned slave who was struck by lightning as he awaited his lynching back in the 1800s. And the window's been changed before. It's been knocked out in the storms before. And every time they replace it, the face reappears. And it's there, again, in Carrollton, Alabama, in Pickens County. If you're ever through, the unfortunate thing about it is there's no reason to ever be in Carrollton, Alabama, unless you were going to Carrollton, Alabama, because it's between nowhere. You're not going from point A to point B and find yourself in Pickens County. It's just you're going to have to make a trip there. But it's worth it. It's the courthouse is one of those old timey ones that sits right in the middle of town. It's got the courthouse square like you see in books where the whole town revolves around the courthouse. It is right there, and there's a sign pointing to it. It's not something you got to look for. It's there, and I've seen it myself, and it's just fascinating. I mean, it's and you can look this up online. If you Google it, there are good pictures of it. Google Pickens County, Alabama, or face in the courthouse window, Carrollton, Alabama. And it's just fascinating. I'm not sure what the explanation of it is, but it's definitely there. And it's one of those things that's been there all my life, and everybody knows about it. So it's really cool. So I love the weird, unexplained stuff that you can actually see yourself, and you don't have to just, show up at a spooky place in the middle of the forest and hope something happens, and you're relying largely on your imagination. I love the stuff that is unexplained, that you can look at it and go, huh, well, I'll be, there actually is something there. So if you're ever on the west side, west central Alabama, it's worth driving out of your way to see.
If you go to Google and type in face in the courthouse window and then look for an image search, in fact, there it is. That is a face in the window of this courthouse, and it's pretty creepy. So you can go up there right now, and there's an arrow pointing to it as well, in case you can't see it on first glance.
Oh, yeah. If you're in Carrollton, Alabama, in Pickens County, let's face it, you don't have a lot of tourist attractions going for you, so you might as well exploit the one you got.
All right, Carl, let's do some plugs here. CarlStern.com. Tell us where we can hear more about Carl Stern.
Well, thank you for asking, because I actually have something to plug this week.
Oh, my.
A few years ago, I released an audio device. It's a flash drive packed with lots of audio shows. There was over 40 hours worth of audio dealing with the history of combat sports, specifically wrestling and mixed martial arts, and it's a show I do over the website that Brian's also involved with called WrestlingObserver.com, and it has lots of research material for those interested in that particular field of interest. And I've re-released it. It's been off the market for a couple years now, and so I've released it again. It's a 2 gig flash drive. But now the announcement I have today beyond that is now I have a Stern Stick 2 available, and it's a 4 gigabyte flash drive, and it has not only a lot of wrestling related stuff and combat sports related audio, but there is a lot of I guess, for lack of a better term, things that would appeal to After Dark fans that are exclusive to that. I've recorded so far 3 hours worth of audio that would be of interest to of listeners to this show. I've done a show on true crime, the differences between real law enforcement work and what you see on television, with my partner of the last 3 years at the police department, Nathan. He and I sat down for an hour and discussed things that are different from what you would see on reality TV versus the real world and law enforcement, how it really works. And then there's a show about an hour long on survival skills and the survival mindset and how to survive disasters and unexpected events in life. And then there's one show which I just recorded to put on there on unknown phenomenon and how dealing with the unknown and possible explanations and what happens and what goes on with your mind when you can't find an explanation and how myths come about and about the unknown. It's a good show. I have to say the show on the survival skills and survival mentality is one of my favorite shows I've ever recorded. I had a blast doing that, and it's something I'm really interested in. I think it comes across in the show, and it will be available next week for shipping, but you can pre-order it now at carlstern.com. It's Carl with letter K, K-A-R-L-S-T-E-R-N, carlstern.com. Go there, you can order by PayPal, and shipping is free. Shipping is free nationally and internationally. So if you're listening to this show over in the UK and Europe, Australia, wherever you happen to be listening to, shipping is free. It's $19.99 for the flash drive. Stern Stick 2 is a 4-gig flash drive, and again, you can pull the files off to your computer and use the flash drive for whatever you want to, but it's available now. The Stern Stick 1 is available for immediate shipping. Stern Stick 2 will begin shipping next week, and so go check it out and order a bunch of them for everybody, carlstern.com.
So check it out, carlstern.com, the Stern Stick. And someday maybe we'll do a show on survival tactics as well. But get the Stern Stick first, everybody. It's going to be a while. But Carl, I want to thank you as always for doing the show today. You'll be back again next week, of course. And we'll be right back in just a moment with Jefferson Davis, the author of Weird Washington, your travel guide to Washington's local legends and best kept secrets, here on After Dark Radio at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We are back here on the show. Brian Alvarez here, AfterDarkRadioShow.com, joined today by Jeff Davis, the author of Weird Washington, your travel guide to Washington's local legends and best-kept secrets. And, of course, I live here in Bothell, Washington, so I'm very excited to have Jeff here on the show. And, Jeff, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Not too bad. The book, of course, available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. I actually went to a bookstore to get this book many months ago. A local, I think it was a Borders, and they were going out of business, and the book was not there, and I was just appalled. But I went to Barnes & Noble, and there it was, and I was very excited. And I wanted to start today, if we talk about nothing else on this show, I just want to talk a little bit about the Maltby Cemetery. You wrote about it in the book. And when I was a kid, that was a big deal around here. The haunted Maltby Cemetery, the 13 steps to hell. Tell everybody a little bit about the Maltby Cemetery.
Well, it's about Maltby. It's really hard sometimes to separate fact from fiction and folklore from folk fact. It's become an urban legend now. It's an old pioneer cemetery in Maltby, which can be hard for some people to locate, and so I'm going to make it a little more exciting and not tell you exactly how to get there. And according to folklore, it is a pioneer cemetery. That's folk fact. And there are a couple families who still are living in the area, and they kind of try and take care of their descendants. And there are all kinds of stories about once you cross the 13 steps to hell, you will start hearing the sound of the people's voices, and there are a couple children buried there, and so some people claim that they hear children crying, and it's become quite an attraction, especially around Halloween, as you can guess.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about you before we get back to this, because one of my first questions reading the book is, obviously there's a million different things discussed in the book, a million different places, a million different stories. Did you have a chance to go to pretty much every single location that you wrote about here, or did you go to most of them and you talked to people about other locations, or how did this book come together?
I'm sorry, I'm really pausing on this one. I'm flubbing it. It was actually a group effort, because these weird books, there's one per state, so I was actually contacted by the people who kind of own the franchise, if you will.
Sure.
And I wrote 9 chapters out of the 12, and they introduced me to my co-author, Al Euphrasio. So mostly by email and phone calls, we actually divided up the book into chapters, and then we actually had to do... I submitted a whole bunch of 1 or 2 line proposals for each place. And then we went and each chapter had, they called for 10 stories, but I submitted 15 to 20 story ideas per chapter. So we kind of cut those out, and they really liked us to travel. And so between Al and I, we visited, I'm nodding my head up and down on the phone as I'm thinking about this, I'm sorry. But we visited, 70-80% of the places between
sure.
the two of us.
Yeah.
Some of the places don't exist anymore, or others, we just were so remote, some of them we just didn't have time.
Now, when you were putting this book together, did you personally get a chance to visit the Maltby Cemetery, or was that the co-author, or did neither of you get a chance to head out there?
Al visited Maltby Cemetery.
Al went out there. And did Al see the steps, or does he believe they're covered up and gone at this point, or did they ever exist?
Al went and he saw the steps, and what's happened more recently is it's been so popular, especially as kind of this urban legend right next to, well, right between all these cities, that that is really, there is posted now, no trespassing, and unfortunately there's been vandalism where people have wanted souvenirs, so they've been chipping away at the headstones. So the property owners, it's my understanding, around Halloween time, usually hire security guards to either do drive-bys or actually watch the cemetery. But about the 13 steps, he and I got into an argument about that, because I guess depending on whether or not you count stepping up to the first step is a step, or when you're at the top, that's another step. You know, you can go 11 or 12 or 13 depending on how you go up.
Now, that's interesting, because my friends, we all heard about it in like 1992. I was in high school, so 1992, 1993. And we went out to find it, because, of course, that's what kids do, and we had the video camera and everything like that. And as you noted, you're not telling everybody the exact location, because it is kind of hard to find, and we actually never found it. We found where we think it was, but we never actually saw the headstones. We never actually found the place. We were kind of disappointed, but, you know, even back then, they didn't want kids milling about looking for the cemetery. So it's like, you know, none of the people that lived there were willing to tell us where the place was, but... A story we always heard was the steps went down. So you're saying the steps go up?
Yeah.
How about that? That's new information. Now did he go up to the 13th step, or did he make it to like 10 and thought, okay, well, let's not press our luck?
I don't think he made it all the way up.
Interesting.
And that's one of those other stories that a lot of people have told about, not just Maltby, but other places, you know, where the sense of unease or fear gets higher the more steps you take. And so I am not sure if that's what happened. I can try and checking with Al and find out more. He and I, well, since the authoring stopped, since Weird Oregon, we meet up occasionally, but not as often as we did when we were actually collaborating.
Now, I won't obviously give the number here, but your number indicates that you live here in Washington, or you're based here in Washington, and how long have you been in the state?
I was actually born here.
Oh, cool. So was I. So, whole life. And I guess, when did you become interested in all of this stuff? And I mean, you mentioned, obviously, that you drew up a list of different places and different topics, and some of these went to the book, and presumably some of them didn't, but... It would appear that you did quite a bit of research before you were asked to write the book.
Yes. my interests actually begin. I'm probably the strangest person in Washington, so I guess that makes me perfect for Weird Washington. Even as a kid, I was always interested in the odd, the unusual. I'd be 12, 13 years old, and I was at the library hanging around the supernatural section of the library waiting for the latest book to like come back from loan or something like that. And even before Weird Washington came out, I was researching and writing some of my own books on the subject, which is how they found out about me. And so I submitted some stories to them, and they liked them. And apparently I was easy enough to work with that that's when I got the offer to do Weird Washington.
What was your, if you had to pick like one single place in Washington that you think is just the strangest place or the strangest story, doesn't even have to be a place, the strangest sighting, whatever that might be, what would you pick as your personal number one?
Oh, there's so many of them. And it's really kind of the unknowns that intrigue me. One of the places I did not get to go to is Mel's Hole, which is one of these mystery holes where supposedly it's bottomless. And Mel was a guest on the old Art Bell show, and I think he interviewed with Art Bell himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he is supposed to have gotten a weight and like an extremely large amount of fishing line and put it down the hole, and it never reached the bottom. And he found odd things at the edges of the hole, dimes, and that had Franklin Roosevelt's face on them, but they were dated 1943, which was before Roosevelt was put on the dime, and things like that. And so I had talked to people who had looked for Mel's Hole and actually taken three or four times to try and get out there and find it, but they never had. So that intrigues me. I really would like to find it or prove that it doesn't exist.
And that's in Ellensburg, right?
Out that way, yes.
Ellensburg, yeah. Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about that one next, because the reason this radio show exists is because of Art Bell. That was my favorite show growing up. I loved that show. And Mel's Hole, I remember Mel calling in and talking about his hole, and it just seemed to go down forever, and he would toss things into the hole, if I recall correctly, and you'd never hear them hit bottom. And I think he even talked about sending like a refrigerator down there and never hearing it hit bottom. And just a really weird story. And apparently there are allegedly holes like this in other places around the country. And I know you wrote Weird Oregon. What else do you know about these strange holes? Where else are they supposedly located?
Well, Mel ended up being a guest later. I think it may have been after George Noory took over, but he claimed that the government was somehow involved, and they bought the land from him, and so long as he moved to Australia. And he supposedly moved to Australia, and he may have even found one there. But he came back to the United States, and here's where it starts getting even weirder than weird. He went and was on a bus. He was going to come out to Eastern Washington to have a look at the hole. And the next thing he knew, it was several weeks later, and I think he was in San Francisco. And but he was been in a couple of areas where that's happened. And in Oregon, they have what's called the Oregon Vortex.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, which is a place where it's not a hole in the ground, but I've been there a couple times. And it is intriguing because according to the people there, they have as an attraction the House of Mysteries, which some of which they admit some of the things are optical illusion and little feats of engineering, sort of like at Knott's Berry Farm and other places, you know, where the broomstick stands upright and you can roll the ball uphill. But they also believe that the Earth's magnetic field does go a little bit wonky, and that objects once put within the center of the vortex there will actually, through the inverse square law, lose mass and size. And this also, according to them, affects time. And I do recall I was there. They didn't know who I was. They didn't know I was authoring a book. And I was in their little gift shop, and one of the guides came in with a handful of watches. And he handed them to the person behind the counter and said, "Well, it happened again." And I kind of, at this point, came forward and said, "What?" And they said to me that they, as an experiment, would take several watches and set them all at the same time and then put them in various locations within the vortex and collect them a couple of hours later. And oftentimes they will all record a different time.
Hmm.
And so that struck me as interesting. If you, they're not necessarily gateways, maybe to a different dimension, but also gateways through different times.
Now, is this a place where allegedly you can stand there and things will appear to roll uphill, or is that somewhere else?
Yes, that is one of those places.
Interesting. Yeah, I've been to Oregon many times, and I've never actually been there, but. In fact, I may be going to Oregon tomorrow, so I may have to put that on the list. But, yeah, I very strange. They're rolling uphill. You know, obviously some people, they talk about, oh, you know, it's an optical illusion and that sort of thing. But to me, even if it is an optical illusion and it appears that something is rolling uphill, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. And like I said, some of the attractions there, they do say, well, this is an optical illusion set up by an engineer. But there are other stuff. They are saying, no, absolutely, what we've shown you before is optical illusion. This is quote, real.
Now, having been born and raised and presumably lived in Washington all your life like I have, it's kind of hard to get the perspective of somebody living on the East Coast. But I would presume, you know, due to Art Bell and Coast to Coast AM and the show going nationally, internationally, that I would think most people in the country are pretty well aware of Bigfoot, for example, and UFOs. Obviously, everyone around the world is aware of UFOs. But it's kind of interesting because as you talk about in the book, obviously a lot of Bigfoot stories from Washington State. And in fact, the beginning of the famous 20th century UFO flap, Kenneth Arnold's sighting of the UFOs, those were over Mount Rainier. And two very Washington-centric sort of stories that everybody in the world knows about.
Right. The Kenneth Arnold sighting, as well as the Maury Island incident, as it's called.
Yes.
And those really predated the Roswell incident by a couple of days to a week or so. And I found it fascinating. Those were stories that I wrote up and submitted for Weird Washington. As I was doing the research, one of the very, very interesting things about the Kenneth Arnold sighting is, in years afterward, various people have reported UFO sightings, and the skeptics will sometimes do outright attacks on them and, you know, try and, you know, smear their name or, you know, impeach them or something. Even at the time, as fantastic as what Kenneth Arnold said, no one seemed to ever question his honesty. And I kind of appreciate that, especially as long ago as that was, and as strange as it really did sound to the audiences who listened to him. So,
do you think that maybe part of that was it was 1947, it was a couple of years after the war, you know, maybe people thought, well, you know, we won the war, everything is great, but, you know, there were strange things being used in this war. Maybe this is a new military invention, maybe this is, you know, I mean, what kind of was the feeling of people? I mean, was it a deal at the time where they thought these were alien crafts, or did that kind of come later with the movies and everything?
You raised a really good point. Some people thought that they were, there were some kind of a military aircraft, and so that was part of what some people thought. Other people thought that they were otherworldly craft. A lot of people thought off and on that they were some kind of a meteor swarm crossing through the atmosphere, and so it really kind of divided about that. But shortly after that too, there were a series of incidents around Portland, Oregon, where people saw lights in the sky. And so these were reported off, not necessarily as craft, but the term flying saucer originated with Kenneth Arnold's report. And I paraphrase, when he was interviewed by a bunch of reporters, they asked him to describe it, and he said something like, it was sort of like watching saucers skipping across the lake or something like mm-hmm. that. And one of the reporters said, oh, he said it was like a saucer flying or a flying saucer. And that's where that story was, you know, that expression was born up. And the same thing, the Men in Black first make their appearance at the Maury Island incident.
That's right. And actually, I want to ask you about that. The flying saucer thing actually is interesting as well, because the term was in reference to their movement. And if you actually look at the drawings that Kenneth Arnold made of the craft, they're not really flying saucers. They're almost, I don't want to say boomerang shaped. They're kind of like, I don't even know how you would describe it. It's like a half a saucer, really.
Yeah, or kind of a crescent.
Sure, a crescent.
Or if you're French, croissant.
That's in fact correct. Now, Maury Island, my wife went to the University of Washington, and she got she did the grad school program, and she did a thesis on a Maury Island mine that was being expanded. And she knew nothing of the Maury Island case. And as soon as I heard you're doing a story about the Maury Island mine, see what you can find out about the UFO. And she had no idea what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. But tell everybody here a little bit about the Maury Island case and how the Men in Black played into that.
Sure. The Maury Island case is another, again, one of these interesting post-war stories where there were a whole bunch of, in those days, lumber was still a huge industry for the Northwest, and there were these floating log jams that were waiting to go to the mill, that they were floating around in the Puget Sound, and they were bordered by like, they were kind of anchored and tried chaining them together. Occasionally, logs would slip out of the anchoring, and so there were some entrepreneurs who were on boats that would collect these logs and tow them back, and they would get a little bit of money, kind of a bounty for bringing the logs back, and they were also clearing the harbors of obstructions. So one of these boats was out, and according to the story, they saw up in the sky, just outside of, off of Maury Island, they saw five donut-shaped aircraft that were enormous up in the sky. One of them was a little bit lower in the sky than the others, and there seemed to be something wrong with it. And they heard some kind of like churning noises and thrumming and throbbing in the air. And one of the other donut-shaped objects floated down, touched it, and they kind of harmonized. And at that point, the one that had been in trouble, from somewhere within it, a whole bunch of metal came raining out of it and into the harbor below, and some of it struck the boat, and it's supposed to have killed the dog that was on the boat and wounded one of the people, and they very quickly went to shore and got off the boat, and the flying objects hovered around for a while and then flew off into the sky. And when the boat crew made it back to, I think it was Seattle or Tacoma, they told their boss, and the very next morning a man in black showed up and took the captain of the boat to breakfast and explained what happened and told him, if you don't keep quiet, bad things will happen.
And presumably he didn't keep quiet.
No. As a matter of fact, he and his boss went ahead and contacted a magazine and tried putting out their story, and they collected some of the metal. There were two kinds of metal, kind of a slaggy metal, and they said there was also a white metal. And the son of the boat captain disappeared, and he was found kind of with amnesia sometime later, waiting tables. I think it was in Butte, Montana. And other odd things happened along with that. And this was before Project Blue Book existed, but the Air Force sent Air Force investigators a little bit later to do interviews with people, and they flew up from Hurlbut Field in their own airplane, and they finished their interview very, very late at night, and they were flying back south, and the airplane crashed just outside of Centralia and Chehalis.
And from that point forward, I mean, throughout the 50s, it was nothing but Men in Black stories, and that was kind of the first one.
Yes, it was. And there were investigations off and on for the next 15, 20 years. And it was only a couple of years ago that some folks who were curious about UFOs, ufologists, relocated the crash site. Even though, to the local people, they'd always known where it was, but they didn't appreciate the context.
Sure. Now, what is the current belief about that story? I mean, it's been many years. They presumably believe they have a crash site, and obviously no hard physical evidence is brought up. I mean, is the feeling sort of today that just a local legend, or is kind of the prevailing belief that something really happened here?
It's the opinion is really divided because, like a lot of things, I cannot remember right now the. One of the two men, not the ship's captain, but his boss.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot remember his name. After we get done talking, I'll remember it.
Sure.
He led kind of a checkered life. It's historically known that he was a pilot with the OSS during World War II. And after this incident, he actually got involved in politics in Tacoma and actually had his own radio station. And in the 1960s, he was subpoenaed to appear in front of a grand jury in New Orleans because he was suspected of having involvement in JFK assassination. So he was one of these larger-than-life people. And so because of that, it's really hard for me to tell, looking back and forth, because the documents, after this airplane crash, it came to the FBI's attention. They held an investigation, as well as there was a separate Air Force investigation because people were killed. And so these documents have been declassified, and you can actually read, minus all the blacking out,
sure,
the findings of the investigators. And there are a couple places where they kind of disagree. There are a couple places where events seem to be, they seem to capture the same events. But at the time, the FBI basically is supposed to have told the people who reported, listen, it was all well and good when it was just you guys talk about flying saucer, but as a result of this, airplane went down and two people died, and if you want us to not prosecute you guys, I'll just let this thing go. So they were definitely told, if you continue pursuing this, the federal government will probably prosecute you for involuntary manslaughter or fraud or something.
Wow. I want to do a couple of more places here, then we'll talk about some strange creatures. Pike Place Market. Stories of it being haunted. There being I think a lot of people report things like an Indian woman, Native American woman they claim to see there. And, I've been to Pike Place Market a million times, but it's always like, it's a weekend. There's a billion people here. I wouldn't see anybody. I mean, there could be and ghost right there, and it'd be one of a million people wandering around. So presumably you got to go there at night when nobody's there. But tell everybody a little bit about the haunted Pike Place Market, because even if you're not a Seattleite, if you ever come to Seattle, you're going to the market. It's just a tourist thing. So tell everybody what they might be able to expect going there.
Sure. I've been to Pike Place Market many times myself, and probably the principal ghost people talk about there is Princess Angeline. And she was the daughter of Chief Seattle, and when Chief Seattle and the rest of his folk were actually moved away from the Seattle area north, really onto a reservation, she was allowed to remain, and she had a little house not too far from, or a little cottage not too far from where Pike Place Market is today. And she made a living by taking in laundry, but she was great friends with people like Henry Yesler and Doc Maynard. As a matter of fact, she is buried not too far away from the Yeslers.
Hmm.
And so she was, within her own lifetime, kind of famous, and there were a couple of books written about her, and she was seen, even as she got older, she had crippling arthritis. She would still kind of walk the streets, and she would sell baskets not too far, again, from where Pike Place Market is today. And she died, and they started building the market or putting it together. And people believe in the area where the flower market is that they still see her sometimes kind of sitting off to the side with a whole bunch of handmade baskets. And when people, I won't say confront her, but when they walk up to see if they can buy a basket or how much, that is when she is supposed to look up at them and then disappear. Yeah.
Now here in 2011, I mean, is this kind of like a local legend now, or are still reports coming in here and there of, oh my God, in May I saw this woman?
I think the last time somebody sent me an email was maybe 3 or 4 years ago saying that they'd seen her. And, you know, she's not the only ghost. Part of the interesting thing, as you pointed out, about Pike Place Market is there are so many people there during the day. How can you tell the difference between a ghost and a living person unless you brush up against them? And the other thing that, that adds to the mystique of Pike Place Market is the fact that, you know, you go up and down these stairs, and they sometimes lead to nowhere. Other times, you know, they just dogleg these stairs off in different directions, and you'll find booths or shoplets that you didn't know existed from 1 month to the next. And because of that, some of these stories, it's hard to tell where the ghost is supposed to have originated at, because they're usually associated with a certain shop. What happens when the shop goes out of business? And so one of the other ones is the bead boy. Now, the bead shop is still there as far as I know, and people are supposed to see a little boy dressed in early 1900s clothing hanging around the bead shop, and occasionally after closing, employees will have beads thrown at them and things like that.
When you put this book together, was there any particular topic that interested you more than any others, like maybe haunted places or maybe strange creatures or just local lore? What was the kind of thing that when you heard, for example, like, I get to investigate the market, you were like, oh, this is my area of expertise here?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. Most of my books up to then had been about ghosts and the supernatural. And so That was a fun thing for me to do. But before then, I have a background in archaeology and historic research. So when it came time to start putting the book together, I was thinking, no, I want the local legends chapter, and I also want the chapters dealing with, you know, the bigger legends. You know, I want those. And so I think Al Euphrasio was kind of like, what, you mean I don't get to write those stories? And I was talking to somebody about this today. In the legends, many of the legends, I actually was, before I even started writing up the weird part of the legend, because I do have this archaeology background, I would just add a little short retelling of the Native American legend or the early pioneer legend of these places. Mm-hmm. I kind of put it in italics, just one or two paragraphs, and I just added that to it. And I finished that chapter, and there was another location. And I sent in the article, and they said, hey, what about our legend? You're supposed to give us this legend to go with it.
So I was, their feelings were hurt.
Yeah, exactly. That was a feeling I had. And I almost did not get the contract to write Weird Washington or what I did of it, because the people who owned the name rights, Mark Moran and Mark Skirman, they wrote Weird New Jersey and Weird U.S. When they sent me the contract, it was attached to an email, and it was a lengthy email. So I did what a lot of people do. You know, I just started reading the email from the bottom up, and very early on, the publishing company said something to them like, "Well, you know, we know that you've got this guy. You want to write this book, but you know, he's an archaeologist. We read his bio. You sure you really want this? Because archaeologists are really boring people."
Nice.
Yeah, so I actually, for Weird Oregon, added that to my biography.
Well, you got Weird Oregon.
Yep, I did.
Now, I guess when I was a kid, we had to go to Fort Casey. It's called Camp Casey at the time. And, of course, they scared us with, I think it was the Colonel's Mansion, I think they said was haunted. And I believe there was also, like, a bomb shelter or something that they made all the kids walk through. It's pitch blackness. You cannot see a thing. And they told the story about, you know, when they built this, one of the guys that was building it died in the cement, and his hand is now sticking out. So be careful you don't run into this guy's hand. And, of course, there's like a bolt sticking up out of the ground, and kids would kick it. They'd freak out because they thought it was this guy's hand. And I'll never forget this, but tell everybody about Fort Casey.
Fort Casey was actually one of Al's stories, so... Mm-hmm. I'm trying to...
So you didn't have to go to Fort Casey when you were a kid?
No, I'm from Vancouver, Washington.
I see. Okay. Well, instead of Fort Casey, I'll ask you this one, since hauntings are your specialty. Whenever I head down to Oregon, I always pass the Green Hill School for Wayward Youths, I believe it's called. And it's like, razor wire everywhere. They're real troubled kids end up going there. Never really heard any stories about it. I don't know if there really are any, but... it appears that there are places like that, asylums and prisons often have hauntings associated with them. What are some of the famous ones in Washington State?
Fort Steilacoom, actually. Fort Steilacoom Community College, which has been renamed now, came about because there was an asylum there. Was it Western Washington? And when they started downsizing the facility, they had all this land, and it had to go to a public organization. So they actually donated it to become Fort Steilacoom Community College. And some of the land has been also donated as state and city or state and county parks. And this facility used to be much larger than it is today. And there are still people who there still are mental health facilities there, but. Like a lot of these places, it really developed a bad reputation over time because when these were built in the mid to late 1800s, there's a certain number of beds and people that they were supposed to take care of. And then as time wore on, they didn't add to the facilities, and so they started overcrowding, and they didn't hire new employees to take care of them. And so there are all these horror stories about that. And at this facility, particularly during World War II, there are all these stories that some of the attendants turned some of the patient wards into basically brothels, where they would bring in GIs who were stationed at Fort Lewis and sell inmates or rent inmates to some of them, and not a pretty story. And the actress Frances Farmer was an inmate there for quite some time. And they did pioneer the lobotomy in Washington State's asylum
really?
System, yes. And so there are all these stories about that. And across, I cannot remember the name of the road, but a road now divides the old asylum grounds and in what's now, I think it's Lakewood Park. There was for a long time, and it's in Weird Washington, that one asylum building that had developed a reputation for being haunted, and they surrounded by a chain link fence, and people would break in through the chain link fence and do some devil worshiping and hold their own ceremonies there. And there were several muggings and physical attacks by people walking through the park, going through the grasses and woods, and coming out on the edge of this facility building. And since Weird Washington came out, they've actually torn the building down.
Not because of the book, presumably.
No, I hope not. Well, we never got complaints or threats from lawsuits, so I guess I'm lucky there.
I got to talk about some weird creatures before we let you go here. On the back of the book, there is a blurb talking about Gulliver's Travels, the Jonathan Swift book, and in some editions of the book it says here, maps show the land of the giants in Washington State, which is fascinating because obviously we have all of the legends of Bigfoot, this giant hairy beast. It really gets you thinking about is that just a strange coincidence? Did Jonathan Swift hear these stories somehow about the state? This state, of course, the Patterson footage was not filmed here, but we do have the story of Ape Canyon. So tell everybody a little bit about Ape Canyon and your thoughts on Bigfoot in general.
Sure. It's funny you picked that one. I worked as an archaeologist for the Gifford Pinchot National Forest, and part of the land of the Gifford Pinchot is including Mount St. Helens, and it includes the Ape Canyon, Ape Caves area.
Hmm.
So I did field work there for about 5 or 6 years, and it's interesting. As an anthropologist, archaeologist, I'm really familiar with the paleo critters. One of them is Gigantopithecus, which is a large ape-like creature that existed, according to some fossil folks, maybe as late as a half million years ago. to other people, it still exists, and that's what some cryptozoologists think that the Bigfoot is. So I was always really interested, and I was always hoping. Well, I was going to say I was always hoping something would happen, but maybe not quite something happening. You know, you never know what's going to happen when you're meeting something 8 feet tall in the woods.
So you don't want to be eaten, but maybe see something.
Correct, and that never happened. But we would occasionally, not from our own employees, but occasionally some of the local folk or hikers would come back in with some odd stories. In the case of Ape Canyon, it was the early 1900s, and a group of guys came up into the Mount St. Helens area to actually try and mine for gold. Gold was rising up in price. There's a little bit of a recession going on, so they thought, well, we're not working too much on the outside world. We might as well try this. We heard there's gold in them our hills.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were out at this little cabin that they'd made, and the cabin was toward the bottom of the canyon, what's now known as Ape Canyon. And one of them is supposed to have seen some large critter walking around in the woods, and he took a shot at it. Big mistake on his part.
Yes.
Because, well, the second big mistake was he wasn't that good of a shot, and he didn't kill it. So two bad mistakes, and that night they were supposed to have been attacked by numerous critters who at certain points threw rocks down the canyon on top of their little cabin, and then they came down and actually started beating on the walls and even reaching in to try and get to the guys. And they, come sun up, the critters took off, and the guys managed to make their way out and make it down, I think, to Cougar, the town of Cougar, and tell their story. And so that's part of the origin of the name Ape Canyon.
You know, that story is so interesting to me, because whenever you hear a story like that, you know, there's a bunch of guys trapped in a cabin, and these beasts are trying to get in, and they escape, and, you know, they never actually get anything like that. You know, I think a lot of people hear the stories and they go, you know, these hunters are either messing around, or maybe they were all drunk, or whatever the case might be. But if you recall, it's very similar to the Kelly Hopkinsville UFO story of the 50s, of the family that was in the farmhouse, and the little aliens supposedly were trying to get in and climbing all over, and they were shooting at them, and this whole deal. Very famous story. And one of the people, one of our listeners on our message board, his grandmother was in that cabin.
Really?
And, oh, yeah. I my mind was totally blown when I heard this. And, you know, she doesn't talk a lot about it, but she just says, yeah, they were small, and it was scary. And, you know, I've got to get her on the show one of these days. But it's just kind of funny that, you know, you hear a story like that and you kind of think the same thing. Oh, you know, these people in this cabin, they were probably drinking a lot of it. No, she was a little kid, and she was in the cabin, and she was there, and she saw them. So I just this story is just awesome to me.
Yeah, that makes it much more real than a friend of a friend told me.
Exactly. Now, have you ever spoken to Jeff Meldrum?
It's been a while. I was on a panel with him about 3 years ago, I think.
Okay. Yeah, he was on the show a couple of months ago, and I think most people listening to this know of Jeff Meldrum. Big-time PhD, and he is convinced that something is out there.
It's a process of elimination. It's not just a matter of saying, well, prove that Bigfoot doesn't exist. That's not the point. Is, do we know everything about everything? Are the laws of physics as we know them set? You know, that's not true. The fact of the super collider in Europe, where they now think that yes, indeed, some particles like neutrinos can travel faster than light.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know everything.
The Cadborosaurus, our version of the Loch Ness Monster, I guess, in the news, because apparently there is footage, a little bit of it, of which is aired on the Discovery Channel, but apparently there is more to come of apparently very good footage of this creature. Tell everybody what Caddy is.
Sure. Cadborosaurus is, unlike the Loch Ness Monster and a lot of these other critters, which are lake-bound. You know, it's the Loch Ness Monster because it's on Loch Ness. And there's many, many of these large isolated lakes seem to have their own critters living in them. In this case, Cadabrosaurus is supposed to look sort of like a plesiosaur dinosaur, but it's been seen up and down the Washington and Oregon coast. So it's apparently a sea-going critter. And various people have claimed to have seen them, and there was a carcass that washed up off of, I think, the coast of Vancouver Island and was brought to a Canadian facility for examination. And so people have turned in reports on critters like this all the way up to, actually, 2007, I think, was one when I was researching Weird Washington, I came across a story, mm-hmm. all the way down almost off Haseda Head on the Oregon coast. And some people have claimed that they've seen or tried capturing baby catabrosaurus or sauri, catabrosauri, and that they make some kind of like a meeping sound. It's like, you know, sheep, I guess, bleeding.
Interesting. And what have they done with them? Just put them back?
That's according to this sighting, yes. This is the bad part when it does start becoming urban legend, is when people post stuff on websites and they never give their email address.
Exactly, yeah. That's a little questionable there.
Yeah.
Now, two more I want to talk about for sure before we go. These are, now we're getting into some really strange stuff. I think most people have heard of Bigfoot, and people have a vision in their head of a Loch Ness Monster. But there are a couple here in the book that I wanted to talk to you about. When I was a little kid, and I read books about strange beasts, I can't even remember what book it was, but there was a story of the Goat Man. And of course, when you're a little kid, stuff like that just scares the heck out of you because this guy's part man, part goat. You know, goats are scary enough as it is. Half man, half goat, terrifying. And I was pleased to learn in Weird Washington that there have been sightings in this state of the Goat Man. Thankfully, nowhere near where I'm at, but there have been sightings. Tell everybody about the Goat Man.
The Goat Man at Fairchild Air Force Base.
Sure.
Yeah, and this is another one of these odd, you know, weird stories. So I guess it's fitting it goes in the book. Usually, when you get these critter stories, usually it's required that it happens in the woods or happens in the ocean, happens somewhere where there aren't a lot of people hanging around. You know, which kind of adds to the fear factor. In the case of the Goat Man, many people, especially in the 1990s, working at Fairchild Air Force Base, reported seeing in one of the armory buildings, like they're walking around and they kind of pass around a corner in a rack of weapons, seeing a naked man who looked like a combination of a human being and a goat, sort of like a Roman satyr.
Yes.
You know, lower half of a goat, torso of a man with horns, and he doesn't really speak, but he like kind of bleats or yells and smells really bad. And so he was reported a number of times in and around the armory building, inside and outside, which is, again, contrary to what you usually expect. You know, there was no woods, and there were a lot of people passing to and from, especially during the day.
Yeah, the Goat Man story, the first one I heard when I was a kid was, I can't remember where it was, somewhere on the East Coast, and the legend was that it was near like a military facility or something like that, and this Goat Man actually had an axe, and he was in the woods trying to kill folks. So a little more, slightly more terrifying, but still, any half-man, half-goat is not something I'd like to run into.
No, but I don't think he'd be eating anybody, though.
Yes. Well, you never know. Goats will eat anything.
That's true.
Now, last one. This isn't... I saw it in the table of contents, and I was so excited, and then I realized it was just a guy. The Wild Man of Factoria. When I first read that, just the words Wild Man of Factoria, I was like, I've been to Factoria. Where's there a wild man here? And as it turns out, it's just a strange fella that kind of dances around. So that was somewhat of a letdown to me. But there are a lot of strange people all around Washington State. And I guess since he was not quite as wild as I had anticipated, anything else in terms of strange beasts that don't fit into the average category of Bigfoot, sea serpent, that sort of deal?
No. One of the stories that I did have fun with was Bat Squatch, though.
Bat Squatch.
And I think Bat Squatch really is the product of an urban legend where Bat Squatch is supposed to be in and around Mount St. Helens itself, in this giant cave, maybe even the eight caves, which were named after the Boy Scout troop who opened them up to tourists, not necessarily because there were apes in there, but he is supposed to have a be like 9 or 10 feet tall with glowing red eyes, and when he flies, his wings expand to maybe 60 feet. And then it starts. If you Google Bat Squatch plus Washington State, you start having all this stuff. It starts looking very much like the Mothman.
Sure. I was thinking more of the Thunderbird.
Thunderbird. Yeah, that Thunderbird is. I started mentioning Bat Squatch. I did say maybe I should talk about the Thunderbird itself instead. Thunderbird is one of these intriguing stories. Getting back to cryptozoology. You know, study of supposedly extinct critters, in that California condors are now the largest bird in the world, but they had prehistoric cousins who were maybe half again as large as them. And people in an archaeological context have actually found bones of these older condors. And even during the expedition of Lewis and Clark, they ended up shooting a condor, maybe one of the last condors living in the Columbia River Gorge. They shot it actually not too far from Astoria. So some people believe that kind of on the edges of some of these mountains that these condors still exist, and they are portrayed in pictographs and petroglyphs by the native people, and so they may just be up there too far for us to see most of the time. And people in airplanes on the edges of storms have reported seeing these giant birds kind of flying on the edges. And part of the explanation is that it takes a lot of lift to get a bird that big in the air. And so maybe they can only take wing when there's a storm.
Sure. One quick thing here, since you talked about your background in archaeology and such, what is your take on Kennewick Man?
Which take? I enjoyed writing that story because it really played to my archaeology background. Kennewick Man, about 10,000 years ago, was part of a group of people who didn't have too many descendants in the modern Native American tribes that are in the region. He came from a group of people that, to me, are really interesting, related to the Ainu of Japan, who were the aboriginal people, the modern Japanese, took over the islands from the Ainu. He represents a very, very old branch of modern humans. And so it was really interesting when they found him and took his bones to a physical anthropologist, just based on the shape of the skull. The anthropologist, a guy named Jim Chatters, thought it was actually a Caucasian pioneer who had been stabbed by a Native American person, because there was still a stone tool embedded in his hip. And so when the radiocarbon dating came back, it showed it was over 9,000 years old. It was quite a shocker for them. And one of the portrayals, one of the recreations of Kennewick Man, he looks very much like Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the Starship Enterprise.
I have seen that bust. It does look remarkably like him.
Yeah, and so I think what Kennewick Man does is shows us that the North America that we see today, or that Lewis and Clark saw, there are vastly different groups of people running around 10,000 years ago than were running around even in the 1800s.
One last question here, then we'll let you go. You mentioned when you were talked about doing this book, you made a big list of different topics and ideas and that sort of thing. And I have written a book, and you know what. What ended up being published as opposed to what I originally wrote, very different. There are word limits. And are there any particular places, stories, creatures, whatever, that you really hoped would end up in the book, and for whatever reason they had to be cut?
Yeah, there were a couple of them. Hanford Nuclear Reservation. I went to Hanford and wrote a whole long story on that, and just for pace, it had to be removed. And, the thought of there are only two nuclear reservations in the continental United States, and everything that goes into it, especially, you know, with our fear of nuclear waste and the green world we're trying to live in today, I was a little disappointed that that got taken out, especially since I ended up kind of getting followed by one of the Hanford police cars, because I didn't want to get arrested. So I told them when I came in, I said, listen, I'm going to be taking pictures for a book.
Yeah.
Is that okay? And so they said, sure, yeah. But I still got kind of followed.
Well, you got to make sure.
Yeah, that's right.
The book, everybody. Oh, any others before I do the plug?
No, that's probably the main one.
All right. The book is Weird Washington, everybody, your travel guide to Washington's local legends and best-kept secrets. Jeff Davis here on the show, and of course, the book is available on Amazon.com. If you're in Washington State, I'm sure it's available in most local booksellers. Not sure if you're living in other states, you probably have to get it online, but it's a great book. It's not all about local places. I mean, if you're listening to this show, you have interest in Bigfoot, you have interest in UFOs, you have interest in a lot of different strange things that are covered in depth in this book. It's a great book. I love it particularly since I'm from the area. It's a lot of fun if you're in Washington to be able to read the different places and then go do some of your own investigations yourself. Just don't get too close to the Mulpee Cemetery. And Jeff, thanks again. I really appreciate it today.
Thanks for having me on. It's been fun.
And of course, thanks everybody for listening. We shall talk to you again next week.